Going to talk about Jesus today, ironically. Yeah. My husband asked me, what are you talking about today? And I was like, Jesus, for real. Like, I mean, that's it. He's the thing. And we've been looking at doctrine. We started last week looking at doctrine. And doctrine, I will admit to you, is a boring word. It doesn't sound very fun, and I know it. But it's really important. It's important because it roots us in truth, capital T truth. And, you know, we are so, like, American. Congratulations, you guys. I didn't hear about the engagement until this morning on my way to church. Yay! Sean and Eden. Woo! Micah Margeson, are you in the house? Micah? Nope, not today. He's usually... Oh, Micah! Congratulate him as well. He got engaged as well. Yay! I love that stuff. Can I ask you a favor? If you are getting engaged or having a baby, will you email me directly? I want to know it. I mean, will I embarrass you from stage? Likely. Yeah, probably. But let me know, because I want to know it. BBrady@b4church.org. Doctrine. How about that segue? It's something we really need. We have to root ourselves in truth. And I think that, especially in America, we've conflated a lot of things to a capital T truth. I know I did, especially as I was growing up. My truth was my truth, my capital T truth. Like, blue cheese dressing is bad and everyone needs to feel it. That is universal truth. But it I have a taker on that. But as I've gotten older, I've realized, no, there are only like five things that I'm willing to say, those are the things I would lay my life down for. Those are the things that are truth. And that is doctrine. We have essentials that make us orthodox, that keep us connected to the Apostles' Creed and the Nicene Creed. And we are an orthodox church and an orthodox denomination, but there are also distinctives that make us who we are as a church. And our distinctives shift around from church to church. Some people are going to sing Holy Forever, and some people are only going to sing Holy, Holy, Holy hymn with no music, no instruments. It's all right. Distinctives are distinctives. There are churches that have distinctives that I wouldn't want to share. I wouldn't want to be a part of that distinctive, but I'll be happy to stand next to them in heaven for sure. So the essentials, though, that's what we want to major on, especially during this series. They're too important to miss. And so last week, Pastor Russ introduced us to the story of God. He talked about the way we as children look to our parents to see our reflection in them, to find out who we are and whether or not we're actually loved, whether or not we're valuable. He talked about sin being the thing that draws our gaze away from the perfect and infinite love of God, and what that love says about who I am and what it means about how I love. And that message moved me deeply. If you missed it, please listen to it because it lays the foundation. And I want to talk to people who have been doing this all your life. You have the same seat in this auditorium since you were 14 years old. Your grandkids are over in kid care right now. You've heard this story over and over and over again. You could recite it in your sleep. Could I just warn you, beware of things getting too ordinary? The story that we're talking about today is spectacular. It's mind-blowing. It's transformative. It's explosive. Please be willing to engage in this series with fresh eyes, with a young, open heart, because it matters too much that we stay in love with what Jesus has done for us. It matters. I was thinking, we were singing that song today. When you move, you make my heart pound, has always been like, I've been really eye-rolly about it. What a silly thing to say. And then this morning I was thinking about how when my husband and I first met, when he would text me and I'd see his name, Cliff, don't listen to this. I'll never be able to live with you if you, I'd see his name come up on my phone and my heart would pound. And it wasn't discipline. It was delight. It was not even in my control. It's just how I felt. And I think sometimes it's easy to lose that for our first love. And so let this series wake us up to the beauty of what God truly has done for us. So we are framing this series on doctrine as a story. I love narrative theology. I love it because it moves theology away from a checklist of things we ascribe to and onto a God we adore. It moves us from the rules and the things, though I'm not discounting them, but it moves our focus to the God that we adore and love and delight in. I mean, if I have a rainy Saturday afternoon to spend reading and you offer me Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice or the instruction manual to my car, I'm gonna pick the story every time. The instruction manual is arguably more helpful, but I'm still gonna pick the story. Who's gonna turn down Mr. Darcy on a Saturday? It matters. And so we wanna frame theology in a way that brings us into the story and helps us understand who we are and who we're not. Who is the star of the story? How does this play out? We wanna see it that way. It's compelling and beautiful, and God himself is compelling and beautiful, so we wanna see it that way. But the danger of narrative theology is that nearly every time, as human beings, we read a story, we're gonna put ourselves in the center of it. Like when I was little and read Cinderella, I never envisioned myself as the wicked stepsister. That's me, wicked stepsister, just making everybody's lives miserable. Shoe doesn't fit. when you read Lone Ranger, when you're little, you don't think, I could be Tonto's horse in this story. No, you want to be the hero. You want to be the center. We are conditioned and wired up from a lifetime of searching for our own acceptance to want to be in the middle. And in this story, we don't get to be in the middle. We don't get to be the star of it, but we do get to play an important role in it, and the role is object of the affection of the star. We're the object of the leading character's affection, which is arguably more beautiful than trying to be the whole story ourselves. So our story begins like every good story begins. Once upon a time, God created. We know the story is about God because it's right there in the opening line. We also know that the story is about God because he's the only one in the story who never dies. So the character, the story, the star of it, center stage, God. Our story begins in a garden. It begins with shalom. Nothing missing, nothing broken. Good. You guys are better than the 9 o'clock. I just want to know, want you to know it. In the beginning, God is, and he creates. He is the hero. He is the subject. He creates and creates, and eventually he creates us. He creates humankind. We are not the star. We are the object of his affection. Adam and Eve are lured away from his love and presence by the offer of something else. And see, this is the thing. Every good story has a big villain. Every big story has an inciting incident, and this has a big one. This is where the serpent comes in and says, God has said, you can't have anything in this garden. Now let me make it clear, Adam and Eve had everything. They had dominion. They had everything. They got to name the animals. I don't know what better thing you could get in life than that. They had everything. And yet the serpent comes and says, God is holding back everything from you. And they at least have the presence of mind to say, no, God is not holding back everything. There's just one tree we can't eat from. And then he says, but the one thing you don't have is he doesn't want you to be like him. You're not the star of the story. And you could be with just one bite. And so they fall for it. They fall and they fall and they fall. We call this the fall of mankind. And this is where they lose the plot. This is the moment when the terms change in their relationship with God. This is not the moment his love changes for them. It's only the moment the terms change. Shalom is shattered by the serpent and by sin. Shame enters. There's no more garden access. And now work will be hard. Childbirth will be painful. And their friendship with God will look different than it did before. It's still real, but it's different. And this is not just the moment shalom is shattered. It's also the moment the plan is set in motion to bring back our peace and healing. This is the moment that God is planning for us, for our redemption. Adam and Eve fall, the world turns to chaos. Cain kills Abel, all kinds of things go on. Eventually, God is sorry he made the whole lot of us. He's just sorry he made it all. He regrets it. And then he sees one man and he calls to, who is that man? Noah. And Noah, he says, will you bring the people back into the storyline of God? And Noah responds, and we're saved. And then all the people after that fall and fall and fall out of the storyline of God. They try to build their own place, their own role. And then we land eventually where God calls to Abraham. And he says, hey, Abraham, will you go to a story that's different than the one you know? Will you move out of your story and into one that I will show you? And he's like, where's that again? And he says, I will show you. Shoot. And Abraham has Isaac and Jacob, who you'll remember, his name was turned to Israel, and Israel has 12 sons. They become the sons of Israel. And at the last chapter of the book of Genesis, the sons of Israel number 60 people. And when you turn the page to Exodus 1, we've been through 400 years of slavery, and they now number, scholars believe, between 1 and 2 million people. 1 and 2 million. And so they have exponentially expanded in number and decreased in autonomy and power and quality of life. And so God calls to one man. He calls to Moses, and he says, will you lead my people out of this wretched story and into a new one? And he does, and he leads them eventually with Joshua into the promised land, and we're saved. Everyone is back in the plot line again. And then we fall and fall and fall until we land in the book of Judges, which I don't even want to talk about. It's just so wretched. If you watch CNN some night and you feel depressed about our world, take a spin through Judges. It's super fun. And then they beg for a king, and God gives them a king. And then he eventually calls to David and says, will you lead my people back into the devotion to my purpose and my plan? And all of these people, I want to say, who look like saviors or look like heroes, do it pretty imperfectly. They mess up a lot, but they still have a devotion to the purpose and the storyline of God. And David does it. And for a brief moment, Israel has a stint on the world stage as a superpower. And then he dies, and the kingdom goes to Solomon, and Solomon has trouble keeping his eye on the prize, and eventually the mixture comes into the kingdom, and the kingdom divides in two when Solomon dies, into Israel and Judah. In the history of Judah that follows, they have only 8 good kings, only 8 kings that follow after the way of God. And in the history of Israel, they have 0 good kings, all evil kings. And so they fall and they fall and they fall until eventually they fall into captivity. And then we land in 400 years of silence. And I don't know, slavery, silence, either one is pretty lousy. There are 400 years of silence where God doesn't speak to prophets and he doesn't speak to priests, and there is no word for the people. And I wonder if they wonder where God has gone. It seems like the story has been derailed. The world is desperate for a savior. And at the turn from BC to AD, the timeline is split by the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. All of a sudden, we hear John the Baptist kind of tear through the timeline on the stage and say, something is coming, your time is now. And then Jesus shows up and says, I'm gonna tell him the story myself. I'm gonna be here, I'm gonna tell them, I'm gonna wear their skin and their hurt and their frustration. He puts on a body where that's real flesh that bleeds and joints that ache and a heart that can break. And he is the hero of our story. He is the one who packs a bag and leaves the splendor of heaven to come into this dump we call home. He comes to become one of us, to speak our language, to show us the perfect embodiment of his Father. He is fully human, yet fully divine. That is an essential. Throughout history, we see splits off of our faith that want to lean on the fact that, well, maybe he was not really all the way human or not really all the way divine. Baloney, that doesn't work. What works is God was fully human and fully divine. Jesus is all of us. He represents all of us in relationship, perfect relationship with his Father. I know how not like God most humans are because I know myself. So in this incarnation, Jesus embodies all of him and all that is us except our sin to save us, but also to show us the original design for full alignment with my will and his will, his world and my work, his glory and my worship. In Jesus, all these things come together. This is part of the nature of God that is not a distinctive, it is an essential. Hebrews 1:1-3 says, in the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times and in various ways, but in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, and through whom also he made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. After he had provided purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty in heaven. He is all God. All of Jesus is in God, and all of God is in Jesus, and he is all human. Jesus came to tell us the story of God. He came to tell it to a world that had buckled themselves in to life on their own terms. He came to tell it to a world that was scrapping for attention and love and acceptance and value, and they were racing the timeline of the sting of death. Jesus comes into that broken place not to berate us or condemn us, but to seek and save and love. He is embodied love. He is embodied rescue. John 3:17, who knew there was one after 16? Isn't that funny? For God did not send his Son into the world that he might condemn the world, but that the world might be saved through him. That word saved is the Greek word sozo, and it means to deliver out of danger and into safety. It literally means rescue, that the world would be rescued by his love through him. That's not a dad coming who's mad at you. That's a dad coming because he loves you. God, the good Father, sent his Son, the great rescuer, to save us from our shattered storyline and to deliver us into a new, beautiful, bountiful life. This is not a surprise to him. From the very moment Adam and Eve lost the plot, God set this plan in motion. Jesus walked our soil and ate our food. He chose many to follow him, and some of them did. He came to everyone, but only some of them recognized him, and only some of those who recognized him believed him. He begins his ministry. He heals, he confronts, he makes the establishment uncomfortable, but mostly he loves. Jesus, God incarnate, comes as perfection to our brokenness. And his dear friend John says, we beheld his glory. He saw it. I feel like I saw his glory this morning when he shows up. As he moves through Jerusalem and Galilee and Samaria, tipping over apple carts and confronting broken systems, the people respond. They either respond well, they're really hungry to hear more, or they respond in anger, which leads to hatred, which almost always leads to death, and in this case, it does. The Jewish leaders rise up. They partner with the disciple Judas and have Jesus beaten and hung on a cross to die. This part of the story is grim. It's brutal, but it's also the most beautiful story of all time. This is the moment, as Jesus hangs on the cross, where all our sin, all our shifting our gaze from his face to our own story, he takes that on. 2 Corinthians 5:21 says, he who knew no sin became sin for us. He takes it all onto his innocent perfection, and in doing so, he deals a death blow to death. He ends the sting of death. as he smuggles himself into death and blows it up from the inside. This is a stunning act of grace. The innocent one dying for the guilty. This is part of God's plan of redemption. It actually is his whole plan of redemption. We see it, as Pastor Russ said last week, we see this start to play out from the beginning in the garden. Innocent blood being shed for the guilty. And this is the culmination, the penultimate. This is the moment where it all is finished. God knew that his son would need to die to free us from the endless torment of death and the grave. And the truly incredible news to me is the plan is done. We live on the other side of waiting for the plan, waiting to be redeemed. The plan is done. As he said on the cross, it is finished. The price has been paid. The grace flows freely, not just for those at the foot of the cross at Calvary, but also those at the foot of the cross right here. The grace is unleashed. All the grace you'll ever need, unleashed on the cross. That price is paid. Jesus came as a rescuing king. It was in his blood. It was in his DNA. He came as a hero, and he did the full work, everything we needed him to do. His death on the cross is preceded by silence and darkness, and then when he finally dies, this interesting thing happens. The Roman soldier there looks and says, "Surely he was the Son of God." I mean, I think he's standing there thinking, we just committed deicide. Surely this was the Son of God. Quote from Michael Reeves, a theologian, says, "There was the Son of God being so himself that even a Gentile executioner sensed it. On the cross, we see the bridegroom loving to death, the Lord of glory giving out his life, the Lord of hosts crushing Satan, the king enthroned." This is Jesus. He doesn't just love us to the point of his own death. He also loves us to life. On the third day, he emerges from the tomb, triumphant, the lion of the tribe of Judah, victorious. The Apostle Paul gives the testimony at the very, I'm going to go through this scripture quicker, but he says, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, he appeared to me. Jesus is still today here being so himself, being himself, if we can sense it. Still the hero of the story, still the rescuer of our lives, still the hope of the whole world. Many teachers have died for their faith. Only one rose for our redemption and for our promise of an eternal home with him. And this is the part in the story where you might think, this just seems too good to be true. What is the catch? What is required of me? Well, I have the answer to that. Worship team, you can come on back. Romans 10:9. If you declare with your mouth, Jesus is Lord, and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. Isn't that a good deal? That seems like a bargain of a deal. You lay down your life, and I just believe in my heart and say it with my mouth. Easy peasy. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. There is a metanoia. We've talked about it. Metanoia is a change of mind, a change of heart, a turn that is required for our hearts to even believe. There's a supernatural introduction, I think, to this truth that wakes us up to the idea of a rescue. In fact, in order to receive a hero, we have to know we need one. And so sometimes, especially in our day and age, we really kind of clean up this whole salvation idea. We try to make it super palatable and easy and you know, like in the era of the early church, they received Jesus at the expense of their own lives and the lives of their family and their property and imprisonment. And it's so every time we do the thing, we do it, and I get why we do it, but every time we do the every head bowed and every eye closed, nobody looking around in case this embarrasses you. Ugh, I don't know. this thing about receiving Jesus into my heart, he's bigger than your heart. I think sometimes if we're gonna actually say, I want to give you my heart, we have to acknowledge this is probably gonna sometimes be a bloody mess. To take this heart that I really am trained to love and protect and want to call all the shots and want to do it my own way, and actually, as Jamie was saying this morning, let go of it and believe in my heart that he is the Son of God and that he was raised from the dead and he is the Lord of my life. To believe that and give him my heart, that's a good story. That's good. Salvation through faith in Jesus is not a distinctive of our church. It is an essential of the whole Christian faith. I know people get frustrated and say, Christians are so narrow-minded, saying Jesus is the only way. We didn't say it, Jesus said it. I am the way, the truth, the life. All of those things. He comes to give us abundant life. And we cannot mix any other God, any other faith, any other doctrine, any other worship, any other idol, any other anything into this. It is Jesus first, Jesus last, Jesus only, Jesus always. That's the essential of our church. I'm telling you what, fight over whatever else you want to fight over, but we will not fight over that. Jesus only. He is the star of our story, and we are the bought with a price object of his affection, and that is beautiful. I want the team to lead us in this song. I'd like you to stand with me, and this song takes us through the life of the rescuer. And I want us to just rejoice in it as we're able to let it fall in our hearts like rain. And as we remember that we are those who have been rescued by a great and wonderful Savior.
Finish the everybody began to breathe out of the silence. The roaring lion declares the grave has no claim on me.
Free forever.
Of the one who loves you and said, I'm ready to rip my heart out, ready to give you my whole life for all of my life. Or perhaps you find yourself in a place this morning where if you got a text from Jesus, you're not sure your heart would pound. Just maybe the decision was made so long ago that it doesn't hold emotional weight with you anymore. That's normal, but it's not preferred. We really want Jesus to be the center in a way that we feel and know and can rejoice in. And so if for any reason you want to say yes again today to Jesus, will you wave your hand at me? We're going to bow our heads. Just wave your hand at me. I see you back there. Amazing. I see you there. Amazing. Amazing. So thankful. Yes. Good. Amazing. All back there. I see you. I see you. Incredible. Love it. We rejoice with you today. We rejoice with angels today. This story isn't basic. This is the heartbeat of our faith. So if you have kids, go right now. Go, run, because they're going to be mad at me. Go pick them up. But for the rest of you, I want to say we are having a book group that meets around a book around every series now. And I believe it starts this next week. There's a QR code coming up on the screen for that. They're going through the book Unbreakable, which is one of my favorite. It changed my heart around how I read the Bible. It's beautiful. I'd love for you to check it out at the Info Center. And now for those of you who remain, now that we've let them go out to avoid the crowds, and for those of you who survived getting here on 217 today, we're so glad. And if you would like to receive the benediction, I want to speak it over you now. May you be men and women who understand that you are the object of the affection of the star of the story. And may you know his delight in you as you delight in him. In the name of the one who truly is our living hope, amen. We love you so much. Prayer people will be down here if you'd like to pray with someone. We'll see you next weekend.